Hi everybody, my name's Thomas. I'm an alcoholic. Nice to be here tonight. My sobriety date is January 25th, 1981. The Potomac Oaks group is my home group, and I have a sponsor. All I can tell you is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that's good in my life today is a direct result of me trying to apply these principles in all my affairs, but it's usually like, you know, maybe half or three quarters. It's just I still fall with regularity. And if you're new, like less than a year, you should feel kind of special because, you know, back in the 30s when this thing started, that's really why they started having meetings. You know, they wanted people that were new to have a place to come where they could get an ounce of hope. You know, and then leaving the meeting, they might just grapple with the fact that there was something good going on here that maybe they could latch on to. And they also found that this just worked better. And this is actually where our first tradition came from. Sobriety seemed to catch on better when it happened in a group format. So if you're new, you know, welcome. You know, and if you're new, you know, I love talking to new people. I really do. So much so that in my home group that I started just about a year ago, we actually do a beginner's meeting. Because where I was sober before I was here in Chicago, there was a guy that started that meeting. And the success rate of people staying sober for a long period of time, it increased exponentially. When people were new, they got fed the truth. You know, and everything that he always talked about in that meeting, and it's been going on for almost 30 years now, that meeting. It's always out of the big book, and it's always directed for people that had less than a year. But there would always be 200 people in the meeting. And there might be only 20 or so, 25, with less than a year. Everyone else just came because it was a constant reminder of, this is what I need to remember. So if you are new, there might be a lot of things about Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't understand, that you don't even like. You know, you might not like the fact that whenever you try to have a conversation with your sponsor, it seems to be very one-sided. Okay? You might not like the fact that, you know, your sponsor doesn't need to hear all the facts that you need to tell him or her. You know, I don't know if they're anything like my sponsor. I usually get like a sentence out. And then I just listen for about 20 minutes. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All right. You might not like the way they set the chairs. You might not like a lot of things about Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you were to, like, have a sheet of paper and just line all those things up on one side of the paper, this is why I don't like AA. This is why AA is not going to work for me. And then on the other side, you would have the answer to that in two words. It works. All right? It's just been my experience. AA works. So whatever you don't like about it, people that I have found that have stayed sober looked at the right half of that column and said, okay, it works. I'm going to do this stuff that I don't want to do, that doesn't make sense to me, and eventually I'm going to get from here to here. You know, because this is where the hope is. This is where change was able to, like, happen in my life. But I need to tell you what it was like, too. I was one of eight kids, grew up in upstate New York with an alcoholic father. He was Irish. My mother was Italian, Catholic. So, I mean, I basically had three strikes against me just coming out of the womb. My mother should have just had me in a meeting of AA because I was destined to get here. And I don't know why this is, but for some reason, out of the eight kids, I was my father's scapegoat. I was the one that got it all. The mental abuse, the physical abuse, just all of it. And I mean, for years, even in Alcoholics Anonymous sober, I was the victim. It's like, that's why I drank. It was all his fault. You know, I remember, you know, nights just being the one kid that would just wait on the doorstep for him to get home. And he would just, like, walk by me like I wasn't even there. You know, so I grew up feeling like, I'm unlovable. I'm nothing. You know, I'm less than. And so then, you know, I would do what any person with my personality would do, because I craved attention. I still crave attention, okay? And so over 28 years, I still crave attention. And he would walk right by me, so I would go in the house and I would make a scene. So if I look back on it honestly, which is a hard thing for an alcoholic, I know why today I got beat so often. Because I'd go in the house and get stupid with my mother, one of my brothers, or my little sister. Usually my little sister or my little brother, because I could pick on them. I mean, I never messed with my older brothers because they just beat me again. So, I wasn't completely stupid, but... And that's the way my life was for about the first 10 years, I guess. Because my father was an active alcoholic. And I just didn't feel like I fit in, you know. I never got enough attention. Of course, when you have a mother that's trying to manage 8 kids that were basically born in succession. I mean, she had 10 in 11 years, okay. So there was always 2 or 3 of us running around in diapers. I mean, it was like, I can look back at that today and see, I understand that. But when I was young, I was unlovable. I never got enough attention. I never got enough effect. I never got enough. And I found later on that that's a word that an alcoholic of my type, I'll never have enough. Anything, you know. Enough money, enough love, enough power, enough, you know. And, you know, now I can say very, very comfortably, you know what, I have enough stuff. I mean, I have what I need. You know, I have peace of mind. Anyway, those first 10 years, it was just like I was constantly just getting abused. And then my dad got sober. And I had my first drink when I was 12. And, I mean, when I was 12, I was, you know, I was not the physical specimen you see here before you tonight. I was like 5 foot nothing. I weighed about 100 and nothing. I was just like a really little, scrawny kid. And a friend of mine had older brothers too that were even older than my older brothers, and he got us 2 six-packs. And I don't know if you're familiar with shotgunning beers. Maybe there's a couple of you who've tried that experiment. Well, I shotgunned my 6 beers in probably 10 minutes. And like, he was cracking his second one and I was looking around for my 7th. And he just looked at me like there was something wrong with me. But in that moment, there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. Nothing. I mean, I wanted to feel that way for every minute for the rest of my life. It's like I had found the answer to my problems. Because in that moment where I was just... Because when you drink them so fast, it doesn't really have time to, like... You don't work into a buzz. You just, like, bam. And 6 beers in that amount of time has a profound effect on somebody that's as small as I was back then. And I just remember vividly, I didn't care about any pain. I didn't care about my dad beating me. I didn't care about being ignored. I just felt great. And I just was certain that I had to do that again soon. Now, of course, the other side of that is when you have 6 beers in 10 minutes and you're 5 foot nothing, you weigh like you're this big around, you can only hold it for an hour or so. So for an hour, I felt like I was in heaven. And then, I didn't know it was a blackout then. I didn't know what it was. I just remembered waking up in one of our neighbor's front bushes, face down, covered in vomit. And I was like, well, how did that happen? And I remember feeling really, really bad for about the next whole day. I just didn't feel right. So I was like, oh man, I'm not going to ever do that again. That just wasn't worth it. You know, I mean, I felt great for an hour, but then I felt terrible for 18 hours. I just did the math. But it talks about that in the big book, you know, how quickly I can blot out what happened yesterday just in search. I want to feel that way again. And so I swore it off for like another weekend, you know, because I just wanted to feel that way again. And I couldn't drink that often because when you're 12, there's just, you know, there's not the accessibility because my brother's friends were busy and my friend's older brothers were busy. But it progressed. I mean, it progressed, and right around that time, my father's now sober. And there was a real distinct difference in my dad from when he was drinking to when he was sober. When he was drinking, all he ever wanted to do was hit me, you know? And then he got sober. And the only thing he ever wanted to do was talk to me. And I wasn't sure which was worse, you know? Because, you know, you hit me, you bang me around, and I go to bed, and I'm done. But he would talk to me for hours. I mean, hours. I mean, I didn't know it was an amends process. I had no idea what it was. He was trying to, like, make up for lost time. I just knew it was incredibly painful listening to him try to explain to me that I really need to try to come to an understanding of God. I mean, I was, you know, now I'm like 13, 14, 15, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I just want to drink. I just want to feel better now. God is not going to make me feel better now. Alcohol will make me feel better right now. And my drinking progressed. And there was dozens, doesn't even come close. I mean, maybe hundreds of times where I would literally be on my way out the door, and he'd be up in our kitchen. And I'll never forget this. The voice from the kitchen. It's just, can you come up here for a minute? And if it had been a minute, it would have been fine. But it was never a minute. It was like another two-hour lecture about how my life was going in the wrong direction. And I was like, all right. And I learned how to nod. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Good. Okay, can I go now? And I would leave. And then, like, the next weekend, I'd be out drinking again. And then the next night after that, I'd be on my way out the door. Can you come up here for a minute? And it was unbelievable. And my drinking progressed. And I started getting into some trouble. You know, he got me a new car, which I don't know why he would do that, because he knew that I was already, like, headed down the road. But he got me a new car. And it wasn't registered. It wasn't insured. And I was so excited about this new car, I just took it for a drive anyway. And when I got home, it was not a pretty sight. You know, it was just not pretty because, you know, he was worried. You know, what if something had happened when the car is not registered, it's not insured? But I don't think about that. I think about immediate gratification. I want to feel better right now. And I don't care. I mean, for years it was alcohol. And today it could be anything else that's maybe not so spiritual. I want to feel better right now. And, you know, dozens and hundreds of talks, you know, can you come up here for a minute? And, you know, I got to high school, and I got suspended from high school 3 times, all drinking related. But luckily I had 4 older brothers that had already been through the school, so, I mean, it wasn't like a fraternity. I wasn't a legacy or anything, but it's like he wasn't going to expel one of the Buckley boys, you know, because so many had gone through the school already. But I kept getting suspended, and I didn't care about any of that. I didn't care. It's like my way of going like that to my dad, because I was still very angry at him. And none of his lectures were like sinking in. And suffice to say, from the time I was 16 until about a month shy of my 19th birthday, I wasn't sober a single day. You know, I did all kinds of other stuff, but I don't talk about that in Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in the sanctity of that, and I believe in our singleness of purpose. But there wasn't a day that went by that I didn't alter myself. I mean, alcohol was usually involved, but, and he just watched me. Now, he's sober like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years now, and he's just watching this happen to his son. And I was the only one out of the, you know, 8 kids that it happened to, but it just got worse in his mind. Now, in my mind, I didn't see what the problem was. I mean, what's the big deal? So I got suspended. I mean, I didn't get expelled. It's not like I can't go to school anymore. It just wasn't a big deal. You know, and my sponsor refers to that kind of like thinking and the way I see things. I don't know if there's any football fans in here. But like, you know, in a football game, they have the sky cam. You know, and so if you're watching the game and there's like a close play like on the sideline or in the end zone and the referee rules on it, and they're not sure, they go to the sky cam, because the sky cam never makes a mistake. It can see the actual thing that happened. Well, my sponsor says, you know what you needed? You needed the AA Skycam. Because if this room could see the raw, unedited footage of what those last 3 years like for my dad, you would have looked and said, kid, you got a problem. You need help. But to me, it's like, I don't see anything wrong with this. Why I got suspended? It was bad luck. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I was with the wrong group of kids. It was always somebody else's fault, and there was always an excuse. It was never my fault. You know? And I did stuff, drinking, that I would never in a million years do sober. You know? I stole from my mother. My mother was a saint. I mean, she put up with not just me, but like all eight of us. And I mean, she was wonderful. I mean, my mother lived in prayer. That's how, you know, she coped or whatever. But she was just wonderful. But, like, I did bad stuff to her. I was really angry at my dad, you know. But I did bad stuff to her. I picked on my little brother. I mean, you know, I remember one night for fun, I was working at a gas station at the time. And, you know, I took, like, 2 or 3 5-gallon pails of gasoline out to the school. And I set the football field on fire. Now, if you saw that, like in the raw, unedited footage, you'd go, what is wrong with this kid? But to me, that was just fun. And that's just what you do for fun. Well, like normal people don't do that for fun, but I am an alcoholic. I crave excitement. I want to just like, wow! You know? I wanted to be amazed all the time. And I'm not talking about the promises amazed before I'm halfway through. I just meant like crazy amazed. And I would just do stuff like that. You know, I did stuff like this job I had at the gas station. I was promoted very quickly, and the guy that owned the station, you know, made me the manager of the station, which was great because it meant that I would have to balance the books. And, you know, back in those days, you actually had attendance. You know, I'm dating myself a little bit, that's okay. You know, and the attendants would, like, keep the money in the pocket because most people paid by cash back then, and you just keep your thing in there, and end of the night, okay, that's for the gas station, that's for me, that's for the gas station, that's for me. And it was like a month had gone by or so, and finally the owner of the station says, look, you know, last night's drop was a couple $100 short. I was like, yeah, Ray, you know that new guy that you hired? I think he's stealing. What do you think I should do? He goes, you fire him. So I did. I mean, poor new guy, he was like, you know, he wasn't doing anything. I was the one that was taking the money. And I think in the 9 months that I worked there, I probably fired 5 guys. And Ray never figured out it was like none of the 5 guys, you know. And that was really towards the end of my drinking. I mean, I just, you know, as my drinking progressed, I needed more money to satisfy my habit. And I did whatever it took to get it. I mean, I didn't care how it hurt you. I didn't care how, I just knew I needed to drink, you know. And finally, a month shy of my 19th birthday, I was on my way out the door, and heard that famous voice from the kitchen. Can you come up here for a minute? And I was like, oh my God, what now? I'm like busy. I need to go drink. He knows where I'm going, and he's trying to help me, but I don't care. I don't want another lecture. And that was the only time in the history of his lectures that it was actually 1 minute. He says, look, you know what? Your mom and I are really concerned about you. You're going down the wrong path, and I don't care if you think so or not, but we got your plane ticket, and you're going to treatment center tomorrow out in Minnesota. And I remember just looking at him like, what? I mean, when you're 18 years old, going to a treatment center isn't like anywhere. It wasn't on my priority list anywhere. It's like, I wasn't like, let me see, what do I want to do this week? I want to go to treatment in Minnesota, like 1,000 miles away from home. And he says, you leave tomorrow. We'll leave at 6 a.m. So I went out that night and did what any good alcoholic would do. You know, I got as drunk as I could get. And I came back in around, 4:30, 5 o'clock, and fell face first on the bed, and about an hour later, he was shaking me, so I threw some clothes in a bag, and we went to the airport. And funny story, you know, at the airport, I had my first spiritual experience. because, you know, the security wasn't really crazy like it is now, but they still, you still had to walk through the metal detectors. And, you know, I was walking to the metal detector like this, and I realized that I had this metal pipe in my pocket that I was using the night before. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm like on my way to treatment. I'm going to get arrested. This is not a good thing, you know. So I did what any good alcoholic would do. I said, Dad, here, take this. You know, I figured, what the hell? He knew. It's like, so what, you know? I'm going to treatment. It's like it's problem solved. Well, he took that thing and he walked through the metal detector and nothing happened. I thought, you know what? There is a God and he doesn't like me. Because I was like, I could have used that thing in treatment just to, like, take the edge off. But that's not the way it was supposed to happen, I guess, you know. And I don't know if you've been to treatment. I don't know if treatment's for everybody, but I know it did me a world of justice. You know, when I got to treatment, I had this bag of clothes, and I checked in, and they took all my clothes. I said, "Where are you going with those?" "Well, you'll get those back when you're ready." And I thought, "Well, what the hell is that supposed to mean?" So they actually took the clothes on my back, they send you into this room, and they put you in these, like, the most disgusting pajamas you could ever... I mean, you wouldn't put these things on an animal. They just thought, and I've got to wear this? And they said, yeah, you're going to wear those until you, like, show us that you don't need to wear them anymore. So next morning we went into treatment, into a group session, and there was this little kid there. I mean, I was young. I was still 18. I had my 19th birthday in a treatment center. And this kid was probably this tall. And he looked like he was about 8 or 9. And he looked at me. And he's like, "First time?" And I was like, "Yes." I was like, "How old are you?" He said, 12. I mean, and I just thought, 12? He said, "Yeah, this is my third time. You stick with me. We'll get through this together." And I was dumbfounded. I just thought, 12 years? Because I was certain at 18 years old, I was too young to be an alcoholic. I mean, people don't quit drinking when they're 18. That's when they start drinking. And so I followed Richard's directions. You know, I stuck with him. And you know what? First day in the group session, Richard says, "My name's Richard, and I'm an alcoholic." And that was like 10 o'clock in the morning. And we went to lunch, and that afternoon, Richard had his clothes back. I was like, "Oh, I see the way that works. That's the first step? Okay." So that afternoon, I went into the group session. "My name's Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic." And I got my clothes back. And I thought, I like this first step. This is good. I'm gonna breeze through these 12 pretty easily, if that's the way that works. Well, what they didn't tell you is, every time you goof up, or show them that you're really full of it, they take your clothes back. And I can tell you, the program was supposed to be 5 weeks, but I was there 7, if that tells you anything. And I was in and out of my clothes more times in 7 weeks than, like, I was at home, okay? I mean, I was, like, just constantly in and out. Like, every third day I would do something goofy or make them believe that I didn't buy into any of this. I still didn't believe that I was an alcoholic. I was too young. So, after 7 weeks, you know, my family came up and we did a whole big thing and it was great. And when I came home, my father was so excited because, you know, he's 10 years sober and it's like the prodigal son had returned and we're going to go to a meeting my first night back. And I was like, "No, Dad, it's okay. You know, I've been through treatment. I get this now. I'm just not going to drink anymore." He goes, "No, I have a better solution. You're going to, like, go to a meeting with me tonight." And back then, you know, they used to call my dad the late Jim B. And, I mean, he wasn't dead. He was just always late. And at the time, I didn't like him anyway, but it's like I had more disrespect for him. Because it's something that he always taught me. It's like, you have a meeting, you have an appointment, you go on time. Because you respect other people's time. But he was always late. And it's like, it just made me disrespect him even more. Now, I know today, he was always late because he was going like 30, 40 miles away to help some alcoholic that was in need. And it's like, we'll get to the meeting a few minutes late, if that's what it takes. You know, if you need a few more minutes, then I'm going to give you what you need. but, you know, we're going to get to a meeting. And, you know, so we got to this meeting, it was an 8:30 meeting, and we got there at 8:35. And, you know, back then you could smoke in the meetings. And I remember, I mean, it was a room not altogether different than this one, too. I mean, it had like a little passageway, and it opened up to this big room. You know, and I wasn't a smoker then. And I just remember walking in, and it looked like Los Angeles in a bad day. You know, like all that pollution just kind of hovering there. It was like this big cloud. And I was looking around the room. I mean, and these were some old people. I mean, you people look incredibly young to the people that I saw that night. I mean, these people got winded playing chess, okay? They were old. And I looked at these people, and I just thought, there is no way I'm going to get this. Because I looked in the room, and it was mostly men. There was a few women there, but it was mostly men. And I just saw 50 of my dad. You know, and I still had a lot of angst towards him, and I thought, there's no way I'm going to, like, get this. You know, and with that attitude, that's, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. And I went to meetings for a few months, you know, really more than anything, just to appease my dad, you know. And I wasn't really doing anything. I was just sitting in a chair. And got my 3-month coin. My dad was like so proud. And a couple weeks after that, I went out and I got drunk. And it was not a slip, okay? I don't even know about that word, you know? I mean, I think, oops, I'm drunk. And there's never an oops when I drink. Because the way it's explained to me, sober always precedes drunk, okay? There's sobriety, though, however that looks. It could be dry sober, it could be whatever. But that precedes drunkenness. So something's going on in my life that I don't like, all right? And I don't want to do this stuff. I want to feel better now. And if I don't have anything to apply, principles or steps or a sponsor, I'm going to do what I know how to do that's going to make me feel better now, and that's drink. And I did. And it was a one-night affair. And I thought, wow, how did that happen? Now, again, I'll revert back to the Sky Cam. If you could have seen the first or, you know, the last 2 or 3 weeks prior to me drinking, it would be very clear to the people in this room why I drank. I couldn't have told you why. I just knew I needed to drink. I needed to feel better right then. And when they say AA will ruin your drinking, well, it certainly, that was the case for me. Because I just felt guilty. I was like, why did I do that? You know, I woke up the next morning and all those problems were still there. They weren't better. They weren't gone. They were still there. I thought, all right, I'm going to reassert myself. And so I started going to more meetings again. And I stayed sober for a year. I was pretty impressed with myself, you know. And one night, I just didn't feel like going to a meeting. And I didn't. I went out and I got drunk. And again, I asked myself, well, how did that happen? How did that happen? I have no idea. I didn't understand back then that every day I don't drink, it's a miracle. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I'm supposed to drink. I'm wired to drink. That's how I feel better. And every day I don't, it's a miracle. You know, and it was another one-night affair that I couldn't tell you why. I needed a drink, and so I did. And then about 3 months later, I got another 3-month coin, and this relationship that I had been in since the time I went away to treatment, there were people in the rooms telling me that I needed to end this relationship because she was still drinking and it just wasn't good for me. And so I ended that relationship. Now, that night, I can tell you exactly why I drank. Pain. I didn't like the way I felt. Loneliness set in. I can't believe I did this. Why did they let those goofy people in AA talk me into doing this? This is like the only happiness I had in my life. Blah, 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 blah. Okay? That night, I was in pain and I drank. See, here's the thing. In that first year and a half, I was in meetings almost every day. Okay? There were some days that I was at 2 meetings, and there were some days I was at 3 meetings. And meetings are great. Meetings are an essential part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and today, I still feel the same way. I could be having a really bad day at work. I could be having a rough day on the weekend. I could be, whatever's going on in my life, I can come into a meeting of an Alcoholics Anonymous, and like literally within minutes, it's kind of like drinking, you know? And this is what I mean. If I have a bad day at work, at the end of the day, when I'm still active, this is what I do. Better. Don't worry, this is really just water with a little tiger Gatorade. It's like nothing funny. But that's what I do. And then I say, I feel better. Now today, I can have a really crazy day. I can have a bad day. And I can come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and like within minutes, I get that same, But the problem is that doesn't help me out there. I mean, it's easy for me to stay sober for an hour in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, you know, it's like a jury. I'm like sequestered. I'm here. You know, but it doesn't help me out there. And I always use the analogy. I mean, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love meetings. But meetings, it's like if I'm really sick and I go to the hospital because I have to get an operation or I'm going to die. I mean, that's what meetings are like, you know. I go to meetings all the time. I could be in the hospital, and I could have, you know, hospitals are great sometimes, you know. I mean, you get nice nurses, they take care of you. Oh, can I get you some more applesauce, Mr. Buckley? Oh, can I fluff your pillow, Mr. Buckley? Can I give you another sponge bath, Mr. Buckley? Oh, yeah, I'll take two of those, please. All right? That's what it's like. Somebody's going to take care of me. But eventually, if I don't get the operation, I'm going to die. Okay? I mean, I can come to meetings all the time. And all I'm doing is getting seat. Okay? I need to work the steps. I mean, the steps for me are that's what the operation is. That's when I start to change. I'm not going to change if I don't take the steps. You know, so if you're new, it's great that you're here. But I'm telling you that the steps are the program of recovery. That's what it says in how it works. All right? I have to take the steps because I don't change without them. I won't. You know, and so, after this third night that I went back out, I was like, I was not even humbled anymore. Now I'm humiliated. Okay, I'm like at my, I was a baseball player. I was actually a very good baseball player when I was younger. And, you know, what? Three strikes, you're out. I went out three times in a year and a half. And it's like, all right, I got to do something different. I mean, they were all one-night affairs, but it didn't matter. I could not stay sober. And it talks about that on page 44. You want to know why you're an alcoholic? Just read the first paragraph of 44. All right. When I start drinking, I can't tell you how it's going to end. I don't know when I'm going to stop. Or when I'm sober, I can't stay sober. I will always go back to drinking. That's what makes me an alcoholic. Not that I feel less than, not that I, you know, am angry. Not, that's all stuff. That's part of my ism. But that doesn't make me an alcoholic. Those two things make me an alcoholic. And so I went back to the group again, and there was a guy, his name was Dave K. And you know, they say that, you know, sometimes God will speak to you through the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That night God spoke to me in the voice of Dave K. I mean, he was this big, but he was thick, and I was like very sheepishly, you know, approached him after the meeting because he was, you know, younger. He was maybe 30, but he was 10 years sober. And I thought, you know what, maybe I'm going to ask this guy to be my sponsor. Because, you know, that first year and a half, I didn't have a sponsor. I just went to a lot of meetings. Okay? So I went up to him after the meeting and I said, Dave, you know, I'm really having a problem, you know, staying sober. And I was wondering if you might be my sponsor. And he stepped back. And that's when I heard the voice of God, because he was a little guy, but, I mean, he was so loud. And it went like this. So, you want me to be your sponsor? I was like, well, I think I just asked you that. Yeah. I said, you know, I just can't get this. Just tell me what I need to do. He said, all right, two things. I said, all right, what's the first thing? He said, shut up. I thought, well, that was kind of harsh. It really wasn't the answer I was expecting. It's like, you ain't coming around here for a year and a half, you don't know your ass from the hole in the ground, you don't do anything, you don't help anybody. It's like, what was that? I said, okay. I said, what's the second thing? He goes, shut up. And let me tell you. But then he went on to say, he says, look, here's the deal. He says, when you're new, what you need to do is what you need to learn how to listen. Because it's in the listening that you might get one pearl, one gem that's going to help you out there. Because that's where your problem is. When you leave this room, what goes on out there? He says, life doesn't stop happening just because you're sober. He says, and your reaction to life will always be the same. You'll always be angry and afraid and resentful until you learn how to deal with that stuff. And he goes, until you learn how to shut up, you're never going to hear how you might be able to deal with that. You know, and then Dave started taking me through the steps. And, you know, I worked the steps. And after a period of a couple of years, I went back to school. Because I was out of high school for 5 years. I know I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just worked. And, you know, this one school gave me a golf scholarship to go to school. I thought, well, this is really kind of great, you know. And I went to school, and I got a new sponsor when I was in school because I was there 9 months out of the year. And he was actually my sponsor for the next 11 years. And things started to happen in my life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I went back to school, and I started doing the things that became possible because I had a program of recovery that required me to take certain actions. And those actions freed up enough space in my head to do the things that I wanted to do. It's like I was able to stop, like, dreaming about what I wanted to do and actually start taking action to do what I wanted to do. And I got through school, and I got hired by Hyatt Hotels, and they moved me all over the country. I mean, first they sent me to Savannah, Georgia, you know, and everywhere I went, now because I had a sponsor, I knew what to do. The first thing as I do is I get connected to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got connected in Savannah, and 2 years later they moved me to Atlanta, and. I was in Atlanta for a year and a half, and I met the woman of my dreams. And a year and a half after that, we moved to Hawaii and got married out in Hawaii. And we were there for 3 years. And, you know, before I moved to Hawaii, when I was still, I was in Atlanta, and I was sober probably 7 years at this time. And saved by the bell. And my sponsor had been giving me direction. My amends were finished, with the exception of my dad. You know, for whatever reason, my lack of being open to God's grace, I don't know what it was, I just could not, you know, make that amend. And he'd been harping on, he said, look, you know what? Eventually, he's like, look, when you want to feel better, you'll make this amend. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And it's like every time I was home, there was always this angst, this tension. You know, every time I was in the room with my father. Now, he's sober almost 20 years at that time, and I'm sober like 7 years at that time. And it was like still angst. And I remember being home this one break, and I remember telling my mom, I was like, Mom, I just don't know what to do, you know. Every time we're in the same room, I am like just filled. There's a knot in my stomach. And my mother, in her very quiet, saintly voice, she goes, well, did you ever try to talk to him? And it's like, you know, my sponsor had been telling me that for 6 years. But when my mother said it in that moment, it's like a light bulb went off. And it was funny because, you know, he was down in the recliner at that time. It was like waiting to go to a meeting, and I was up in the kitchen. And I said, hey, Dad, can you come up here for a minute? And it was like sweet payback. It was great. And, you know, and I made amends with my dad. That's the only time in my life I ever saw my father cry. It was just a very, very powerful experience. So if you're not at that place yet, I would tell you just don't delay, because the people that I sponsor today have had some really amazingly profound experiences when they just clear out that record. It's just a very powerful thing. You know, I often talk about, you know, the amends, and it's a little bit grotesque, so I hope you'll bear with me. It's like, It's like when you drink too much and you have to, like, throw up. I'm sure that's never happened to anyone in this room. You all held your liquor much better than I did. But, like, you throw up, right? That's like steps 4 and 5. You get rid of the garbage, right? But then, you know, if you've ever had the experience of, like, that dry stuff after, and it's like, it's just very painful. It's like, you know there's more, but there's really not any. Well, 8 and 9, that's that last bit of stuff that, like, finally comes out. That's, like, at the very end. It's like, that's the last of my garbage that I had to get rid of. If I want to really feel better, it's like, you know, because, like, after you get through the dry stuff and then that last little bit comes out, I don't know about you, but I always slept very well after that. But it wasn't until I got rid of that last little bit that I felt better. The amends were the same way for me. It's like, I did 4 and 5, and I felt better. It's like, I felt a little bit lighter. It's like, okay, this is okay. But when I made amends, more of it came out. When I made that amends with my dad, it was like, I was done. And it's like, then I just, you know what, I could look at anyone, anytime, and not worry about what they were thinking or what I had done. I felt better. And when I moved to Hawaii, it was only about a year later, but I mean, for a year we had a very solid relationship. And so I went home from Atlanta because, it's, you know, when you go to Hawaii, you don't know how long you're going to be or when you're going to come back. And I went home to see my mom and my dad, and he drove me back to the airport, and I hugged him. I told him I loved him, and he told me he loved me, and I flew off to Hawaii. And a week later, he was dead. He had a massive heart attack. And let me tell you, there are very few days I go by that I don't think about, you know, that moment of grace when I was opening up long enough to listen to my mother to just do that thing. Because as an alcoholic, I don't need a lot of, like, urging to, like, whack myself over the back with, like, a, you know, whatever. And, like, just beat myself up. I'm a professional beater-upper of me. All right? I don't need any help doing that. And I just think about all those nights that, like, for the last, I mean, November, it'll be 20 years ago that he passed away. You know? And for 20 years, every time I think about my dad, I have happy memories at that time that we had together. And there's been, like, no beating up, no necessary. And it's like, if I hadn't made that amend, it would have been 20 years of angst I'd been walking around with, you know. That last little bit that I didn't throw up, it would not be good. But luckily, you know, God's grace was sufficient for me to do what I didn't want to do but needed to do. So I'm in Hawaii, and I'm loving life, with the exception of the fact that my father had passed away. Well, a year later, my wife's father got cancer, and then he passed away. And so we moved back to Chicago, and there was, like, all these bets from the people in Hawaii that, you know, 3 months after we moved back, she's going to be pregnant, 1 month, 4 months, 6 months. Like, everyone knew as soon as that we left Hawaii. And you know what? They were right. Got back, and we moved to Chicago, and she got pregnant. A couple years later, she got pregnant again. I have 2 beautiful sons. And, you know, I got connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the hotel that I was managing in Chicago, there was a meeting in that hotel 5 nights a week. It was a very, very great thing for me. But right around the time I was 16 years sober, my sponsor passed away. And he'd been my sponsor the whole time I was in school and then all the years after. I mean, he was a great AA. You know, he wasn't like a circuit speaker or anything. He was just a guy that suited up, showed up, and he was in meetings, and he helped other alcoholics. Because at the end of the day, that's, excuse me, what's really important. And when he passed, I didn't get another sponsor. I was busy. I was busy with my life. I was going to meetings, you know, but I was unchecked by anybody. 4 nights a week, I was in meetings. And I remember, like, calling home to my wife and saying, "What's going on, dear? You know, I'm very busy at the hotel." I would go in at 6 in the morning, and sometimes not get home till 9 o'clock at night. It was just, you know, it was a 2,000-room hotel. It was very busy. And there were many nights where I would call, and she's like, "I'm not good." I was like, "Well, what's going on?" "Well, your older son just knocked over the lamp and broke," and it was always, you know, it was something. You know, they were 3-in-1. They were being 3-in-1. They were, like, a lot for one person to handle. And so I just started going home. You know, I was sober 16 years, and I thought, well, you know what, this is why I got sober. so I could be a present father to my children. I wouldn't abuse them. I wouldn't. They wouldn't get what I got. They were going to get like somebody that just loved them and took care of them. And I just started going home. And 4 meetings a week became 3 meetings a week, became 2 meetings a week, became 1 meeting a week. And this all happened over a period of a year and a half. And just before I was 18 years sober, she had had enough. You know, I don't know who you are, but you are not the person I married. Because untreated alcoholism is very ugly. And I don't need to drink to become very ugly. Right? I just don't need to. When I start worrying about more about what I'm not getting as opposed to what I can give her or give my kids, and I start keeping a score sheet, you know, because I'm like that. Well, let me see, I worked today, I got home, I did the dishes, okay, I bathed the kids, I put them to bed, Okay, well, what about me? What are you going to do for me now? And I, you know what? It talks about it in the book, you know, she got silent scorn, she got moodiness, she got anger, she just got ugly. That's all she got from me was ugly. Now, that's what I look like, untreated, unsponsored, at 18 years sober. All right? And finally she said, look, I've had enough of this. I'm done. And I got divorced, 18 years sober. And I'm still managing the hotel. I'm still busy. I'm living in this big house in Chicago. And we had this huge function. We'd been planning it for months. Well, the function came off without a hitch. It was like magnificent. All the people from our corporate office were there, and it was like they were all congratulations. We had this big celebration in the hotel restaurant. And mind you, I've been going home now every night. I haven't been to a meeting in this whole month. Just going home to this big house and just like looking around at all the, like what's missing. And that night, there was a celebration. And you know, they started cracking open these $100 bottles of wine, and I remember that night like it was yesterday. Just looking over at those bottles of wine on the bar, thinking, you know what? That doesn't look like a bad idea. And all I can tell you is I had a moment of grace. Because in that moment, I hadn't had a thought about drinking in probably 17 years. The obsession had been removed as a result of working the steps. I hadn't even thought about it. So when it hit me, I was like, what? It's like I heard a little something. I don't know if it was a voice. I don't know what it was. It's like, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to go find a meeting. And so I just looked at the people at the corporate office and said, look, I can't be here. I got to go. I said, go ahead. So I left and I went and found a meeting that was about 2 minutes down the street from where I lived in this house, you know, completely unaware. And I went into that meeting and I had a second moment of grace. I raised my hand because I asked if there was anyone there for the first time. And I said, yeah, my name's Thomas. I'm almost 18 years sober. And 30 minutes ago, I almost took a drink. And trust me, that had to be grace. Because there is no way I could have mustered up that kind of ego deflation at depth to tell a room that was probably almost 200 people at 18 years that I almost took a drink. I mean, I wanted to say, well, you know, on page 88, this is what it says. I mean, that's my personality. I want to be like a show-off. But I was done. I was lost. And you know, a guy after me rose his hand, and he just, like, across that room to that corner, he just never lost eye contact with me. And it's like, it was just a very, very powerful thing. I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, look, I really appreciated what you had to say. I need a sponsor. And he just looks at me and goes, yeah, you think so? And he says, well, you know, I sponsor a few guys. Let me talk it over with my sponsor. And he called me back the next day, and he says he could sponsor me. And he's been my sponsor now for the last 10 years. And, you know, I found out later that he actually sponsors more than a few guys. He sponsors like 32 guys. He's a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he has taken me through the steps again. And you know what? I needed to go through them again. I needed to look at how unmanageable my life was. See, because that's really the first step. I mean, that drinking is like just the first half. The second half is, how is my life unmanageable? It's not about like lost jobs and lost cars. It's like, what are those things in my life that make me so tight that I want to drink? You know? How do I get, when alcohol is removed, well, 18 years sober, and alcohol is not there, and I don't have a program, I get crazy enough that I get divorced to the woman of my dreams. I mean, that's unmanageability. All right? You know, when he got me back in touch with the higher power, who I was certain had no interest in me anymore, because I completely screwed it up. And he reminded me that, you know, God had been forgiving sins for about 3,000 years, and he didn't think that I was the one guy that had pissed God off so bad that I wasn't going to get forgiveness, you know? Because I was sure I was the one guy. It's like, no, I can't go there because he's just done with me. He goes, yeah, okay. You know what they call that? And I said, what? Ego. He's like, thank you, sir. You know, and today, you know, we do this stuff, you know. And today I try to stay in 10, 11, and 12 because I've been through the first nine, and I just try to stay in 10, 11, and 12. You know, and there's pages that I read every single day. I read pages 86 to 88 every day. You know, because there's a couple of great lines in there. You know, one of my favorites is, could be my two favorite words in the big book. It's at the bottom of, I think, 87. As we go through the day, it says, we pause. I'm telling you, those two words have been huge in my life. And I mean, I've had a couple of great pauses. I mean, I had a pause that night when I was going to drink that God's grace entered in there. And I didn't drink that night. Right? You know, I was in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. I was actually living there at the time. And I remember going through this and like everything I owned was like washed away. Like within a week of that, my older son had an accident and my wife called. And, you know, she wanted to know if I could send her a couple $1,000. Now, I paused because my first thought was, are you watching the TV? Do you know where I live? Do you, like, that's my stuff floating down into, like, the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, I knew she had a TV. She got it as part of the deal, you know. It was a nice TV. So, I mean, my first thought wasn't, is my son okay? Okay? That's alcoholism. Still, my first thought is sometimes not the best thought. See, and this is something that my sponsor has taught me. He goes, I don't care how long you're sober. You will never, ever be able to prevent that alien thought from getting into your head. It's just not going to happen. He goes, but this is what Alcoholics Anonymous will teach you. This alien thought, whatever it is, you know, maybe it's a resentment. Maybe there's somebody in the meeting that really kind of pissed you off and you're just kind of like hanging on to it. He goes, you know, you have a resentment. It's kind of like that old friend of yours that you didn't really like anyways, that he's out on the sidewalk and you're up on the porch and you might maybe wave to him, okay, and just let it keep going. That's the resentment. I'm just going to let. But that's not what I do. I'd be like, oh, yeah, how you doing? Yeah, why don't you come up onto the porch for a while? You know? And all of a sudden the resentment's up on my porch, in my head for like another 5 minutes. And it starts to feel so good. It's like, you know what, why don't you come in and have a cup of coffee? And all of a sudden that resentment's in there for another hour. And it's like, you know what, this feels so good. You know, why don't you stay for dinner? Now the resentment's in there for like 8 hours. And it feels so good. It's like, you know what, why don't you just have a sleepover? And then I wake up the next morning all angry and full of angst. And I wonder why. Because I just didn't let it stay on the street and walk by. See, and that's the difference today. I will not prevent that alien thought from getting in there and making me crazy. But I can just let it keep going. All right? And that's something I only learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's only God's grace. And maybe, like, not thinking about me, but maybe calling somebody I sponsor and say, how are you today? That helps me not do that stuff. You know, and I'm running out of time, but there's something I really want to touch on because I always touch on it because it's very important. You know, on page 45, it says the main object of this book, you know, and there's a lot of good stuff in this book. I don't know if you've read it or not, but you should read it. It's like, there's a lot of good stuff in here. But on page 45, it says the main object of the book is to help me find this power that can help solve my problem. You know, and it doesn't matter what that power is. It has to be greater than me. You know, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. It's helping me tap into that power. And sometimes I tap into it just by showing up at a meeting. Sometimes I tap into it by picking up the phone. Sometimes I tap into it by getting on my knees and asking God for help, you know. And my prayer life has improved dramatically because in the 11th step it tells me I have to improve my conscious contact. I mean, if I'm praying the same way today, 28 years later, as when I got in here, I might be missing the boat, you know. I'm supposed to improve it. I'm not supposed to just pray the same way. And You know, on 88 it says, it's really funny because I love the way it's worded. These guys are geniuses. I'm talking about prayer, it says, it works. Now, the first time I read this, like, yeah, I know, it might work for you, but it's not going to work for me. But then there's a dash. And if you know the English language, if there's a dash, it means end of thought, new thought. And then it says, it really does. And it's like a gun, like right to my head. Like, yeah, it's talking to you, bozo. It really works. And what I found is when I devote that time to taking that action, then I have more peace in my day. You know? Life is still happening, but I don't react to it as badly as I used to. I'm going to say one last thing. I'm going to shut up. You know, back when that thing happened, you know, at the Hyatt, and I met my sponsor. It was a couple years later. He was not able to make this trip to Rome, and we had a chance to have a private audience with Pope John Paul II. Now, that might not mean anything to anyone in this room, but for me at that time in my spiritual walk, that was like a big deal. I mean, it wasn't a guaranteed thing, but it might happen. And it wound up that it did happen. And I asked him if there was anything he wanted me to do when I was there. And all he said was, yeah. He says, just before you get ready to meet the Pope, he says, I just want you to think back to that moment 2 years earlier when you were going to drink and you decided not to do it. I want you to think about how your life has turned out because of that one decision, that one moment of grace. Because a lot of times, you know what happens? I ignore them. I miss them. It's like my radar are so defective, I don't see that grace when it's right in front of me. And I don't know that simple decision, how it's going to have a rippling effect. So 2 years later, now, because I said no, I'm in this place where I get to meet a guy. It's like, to me, it was just a very, very powerful experience. So, if you're new, don't miss out on that. You know, jump in. Jump in because this is where it happens. This is where, like, you stop dreaming and you start living. You know, I owe everything that's good in my life to AA. I said that when I started and I'll say it when I finish. You know, I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for bringing me back to God. Thanks very much.